king of the nation.
Now, let me see. 51552 is our text. And first of all, thanks for all the texts we're sending in. Last weekend, myself and my wife and our friends attended the Queen Bitch Quiz at the Bowie Fest. My God, we were talking about that this day last week. Our team quizzing the aliens didn't do too well on the day, and although we didn't know it at the time, we got together for what was essentially a celebration of Bowie's life. Nice way to say goodbye. Also, Sue Good in West Cork saw Bowie in 73 in the UK. Totally blew me away. Outrageous and life-changing. He will live on forever. Bowie songs, appreciating the legend, waiting all week to hear some last out of the radio. Well, in fact, we will be playing a lot of David Bowie songs tomorrow on the program. It's a lot of talk today, but an awful lot of just songs tomorrow. And over on what is it, RT Gold at 6 o'clock this evening, I'll be playing my 10 favourites. Well, something like that could change by 4 o'clock, who knows. I'm 30, not that young, but young enough to continue being inspired by Bowie's dynasty, and will continue to bring this forward to future generations. I was at the first gig in the Docklands in London in 1990, had no ticket, it was sold out, but just as Bowie came on stage, this woman went into labour and her husband gave me and my wife their tickets as we were first in line at the front door. What a show. Great memories. Danny and Letterkenny. I was at that in 1990, covering that for Channel 4, interviewing Bowie fans on the way, coming out. Bizarre stuff. Anyway, what we're going to give you now is an interview with David Bowie between now and 1 o'clock. So let's start with some music. This one I think you'll know pretty well, frankly, because this goes back. We've mentioned it a bunch of times, actually. And this is Space Oddity. 51552 is the text.
David, you've always switched styles and always switched moods, but I mean, the way you're switching lately, it just seems so effortless. Now, is it? Is it just a natural thing for you?
Yeah.
Or do you have to work at it?
No. I think because my interests were always in, at any given time, or in new music, period,
yeah.
Is that I've always, that's always been, whereas other people possibly would be more interested in what's happening in the mainstream, and that would be probably the body of their record collection. My record collection looks like some kind of bizarre relic-oriented scrapyard of everything from industrial to old Harry Park stuff from California, legendary Stardust Cowboy, Wild Man Fisher. I mean, it's got the most bizarre things in throughout the years, and those are the things that I listen to. I like that.
Wait a minute. Legendary Stardust Cowboy, I know well. I mean,
yeah.
He's got this guitar he made out of a bucket, and he hangs on top of the bonnet of cars.
He had a one-legged trumpet player.
Right, he did, yeah. Wild Man Fisher, I once heard a double album called An Evening with Wild Man Fisher. Now, hold on, I actually bought a Harry Parch album once.
Really?
But yeah, I've got
good
it.
Man.
No, I'll tell you what, I went and asked the Rolling Stone about Harry Parch.
Yeah.
I went to a shop in New York and I bought it in there. And he's got all these things like, he's got a song called Barstow on the world of Harry Parch.
Yeah.
And he's made all these like gourd tree instruments and
that's
things that are like chimes when you walk in the door. And but I mean, the guy.
There's actually a school of Harry Parch in California, and that they've resurrected all those instruments. They found them in his warehouses after he died. And they've refurbished them all. And they've got 60 or 70 of these huge instruments that he made out of glass and tin cans and stuff that they actually executed in
place. Okay, well, I'll tell you, there's one side of that album that has no vocals on it.
Yeah.
And I had it on vinyl in the old days of 45 and 33.
Yeah.
And when I played it at the wrong speed, and I didn't know until I turned over the other side and the vocals were different. I didn't even know it was the wrong speed.
But those kinds of things... I think they're glorious. I mean, I played 78s at 33 and got really good ideas from them. But that it's like it's playing around with all those sonic areas.
Yeah.
You know, that's what makes life interesting. I don't want to just put down information I already know. And that's not what I want to do in life, you know. I really want to just sort of keep changing the spin on what sound can do, you know.
Well, then, besides the sound, what about the tools? I mean, is it technology with organic instruments? Is that the
That's not really changed since the late 70s. That's pretty much where I'm at. And that hasn't changed at all. So the interesting thing for me is that in those days, there weren't that many of us doing it. There was a large group. But not like it is today. But it is because we were doing that back then. It's the vocabulary that I completely understand. So the atmosphere at the moment, the way people use randomization and fragmentation and the way that they treat and abuse their computer subject matter is something I'm entirely comfortable with. So for me, it almost feels like coming home in that way, sonically, far more than, say, the 80s, which I really... I had such a bad time kind of feeling in sync with it all. So this period, it really feels, again, sonically, like a continuation of the late 70s in a way. It's like it's picked up from what was happening back then, even though there's been a swell all the way through the 80s with bands as diverse as Glenn Branca and Sonic Youth and Pixies and whatever, probably Ministry and all, you know, sort of the industrial movement that was happening then. Those roots that were in the late 70s are something that I understand completely. It's the language I speak.
Okay, but then, like, if you get, like, Low Heroes Larger end of 70s,
yeah,
and then Let's Dance, the most commercial.
Well, then Scary Monsters.
And Scary Monsters.
Which also probably was the more industrial of the four albums in its own way. It was, again, harder edged, and the drum sound was even more destroyed than it was on the Berlin albums.
Right, yeah.
And that was thanks to Tony Visconti, by the way, who I would cite as being responsible for the change of tonality in drum sounds. When he brought in a harmonizer in 76, it complete drums were never the same again.
Right. But do you think in some ways, like, after commercial success, they've left dance, like you're saying, that the 80s, you might have needed those 80s that weren't that great, Tonight in 84 and Never Let Me Down in 87. Do you think you needed that to get through the way you are?
I think
the difference and the distance between David Bowie 96 day or David Bowie 97 as opposed to David Bowie 76, it's just a million miles.
Well, I think you're wrong there. I think that I'm closer to what was happening in 76. The Station album is, it has aspects, for instance, the first track, Station to Station, you can identify far more of the signals on that with what I'm doing now than, say, what you could do in 87, when I had things like Never Let Me Down, which is like, why was I making that? You know, it did 87, probably 84 and 87, the two albums that I produced in those years, almost had nothing to do with what I'd written before or subsequently. I mean, they really were odd albums. They were the odd men out. But that's okay. I mean, it's you've got to be prepared to do crap, you know, to get to the good stuff. If you're going to push all the time, you've got to really be prepared to look like a pranny and do terrible things at some point or other, and just keep assuming that if you keep going through everything, eventually you'll see light at the end of the tunnel, and it won't be an oncoming train.
Right. Well, then, is the pinnacle of pranny?
I like that. Pinnacle of pranny.
The year after, Never Let Me Down. In other words, Glass Spider.
I
didn't work for me.
No, it didn't work for me either. In anywhere larger than a 5,000-seater.
Yeah.
In a 5,000-seater, because I designed it to be an all-enveloping kind of spectacular, in as much as it was a bit three-ring circus, there was always three or four events happening at the same time on stage. Yeah. It was multi-event, a very fast event horizon. Individually, there were some incredibly good ideas on that stage. And in a small environment, it really worked well, because when your audience, when your nose is pressed against it all, it's kind of, wow, it's like a wonder world. But to put it, when you're 1,000 rows back, it just becomes this huge mass of confusion. None of it makes any sense, and that was a really bad mistake.
No, I never thought of that it would have worked so well. You're right, it would have worked, because I started out in the field with 30,000 people.
It's just, it was a really bad conceptual idea for that size of place. And I was really designing on an intimate level, and I didn't really get that. I was too thick to realize that it wouldn't translate in a big place. I soon found out. But I look at it, actually, for me, works better on video than it ever worked live, because you have the intimacy of the camera being there on the stage, seeing all the different things that are happening.
Is the point for you then constant reinvention, or is it just that the excitement of the shock of the new is just what excites you?
The reinvention thing, I don't buy into that at all. I think there's a real continuity with what I do, and it's just about expressing myself in a contemporaneous fashion. The reinvention thing, it's an easy description, isn't it? Hey, Dave, you're a real chameleon. You know.
I didn't say
Well, you know something, David, I'm probably the chameleon of rock, you know, because what I do is all about cha-cha-cha. You know, and it's kind of gets all that. And then,
I did it,
you
know, me.
And then the French you get with, why did you kill Ziggy? And the cliches are, you know, a stack high. But what I much prefer to just think of myself as a modern working artist. It's as simple as that. And I just work within the fabric of my society, and it's the things, the enthusiasms that I have for the things that I feel are important in our culture, and I try and use the threads of those compositely for the kind of thing that I try and do, whether it's visual or musically.
Okay, so I won't make you mention names, but I'll make the names of your peers, say from Rod Stewart, right around to Elton John. They surf the mainstream. They're in the middle of the road all the time doing what it is they've always done. Hmm. And, like, how dare anybody suggest they should take on anything that's happening around them in a younger context because it doesn't work for them or they don't want to do it. But it's a cop-out, isn't it?
We obviously just have different perspectives. I think it's this, that my choice...
Always a diplomat, isn't it?
It's not that, honestly. I mean, I just don't think we do the same thing. I think we're both in the music, or all of us are in the music field. It's just my choices that have always been very different to my contemporaries, and my even my very close friends who are of my age and are my contemporaries, we don't actually have the same ambitions at all, not even remotely. And probably my fixation is that I could have been a painter,
I could have been a painter,
or I could have been a musician. I opted for being a musician, but really I still apply, I probably my mind is much more in the more in the field of a painter than it is of a musician in that way. I don't know. Oh, stop it.
Okay, well, hold on. How about this? Wait a minute. Then on that point, the description that somebody gave of you lately, will you accept this? The Beck and the Marsh Lab boy who was sacrificed to rock music in the late 60s has re-emerged as the gentleman artist collector patron of the 90s. Oh.
It's all a bit Dane Bowie, that.
It's having played Lab Bowie, all right?
I'll go back to you. I'm sorry, I won't shift from I'm just a working artist.
Okay, but
working probably in a modern field.
Okay, and there's no way David Bowie wants to work with a safety net, if you like.
Not really, because when I've endeavoured to do that, I've just felt that the most dissatisfied creatively as I ever could feel, and I really felt that I was just destroying everything that I thought worthwhile in my work, and I felt really disappointed in myself. I thought that I was letting myself down, letting my work down, and I would have quit. I really would have quit. I think I really would have gone back to just sort of, you know, immersing myself in the visual arts. It was it seemed at one time a real easy decision, you know. Here I was making lots of money, performing to these huge audiences, and thoroughly uncomfortable and unhappy with life. And I was getting more enjoyment out of just being back in the studio, I mean the painting studio and all that. And I thought, well, why bother? You know, I've got nothing left that really. That's it. You know, I've come to the vacuum of my life. And I guess, you see, I was around 40. So, you know, looking back on it, one also wonders if it wasn't sort of the inevitable midlife crisis as well.
Yeah.
Because it all happened in my sort of 40 to 44 period. I tried, you know, so hard to feel okay with it all. But it was just obvious to me that it was all going incredibly wrong. So I was about to give up. And if it hadn't have been for Reeves Cabrales, my guitar player, I probably would have. But he was, he's such an unquenchable, pithy, witty, intelligent lad. And he said, well, there is a second option, and that is you just completely back off everything you're doing and just try doing all the things that you used to enjoy. The reason that you started doing music in the first place, and the result of that, of course, was Tin Machine, which I know it's hard to believe is actually the best thing that ever happened to me in that way. There were 4 years. It wasn't an overnight band either.
No.
We were together for 4 years. It was a long period. Most bands are together less than that and they break up, you know. We really stuck it out, and in that period I think I learnt relearn what it was to write for myself, not try and meet an audience's expectations, and that really set me back on the path of what I like doing.
Prodigy and Hunky Dory, the man who stole the world, of course. You listen to David Bowie here at Interview. It's had a workout the year. I don't have it written on it. I think it's 1997, is it? I think it probably is 1997. This one, the one on TV last night, was 1987. Crikey. Okay, where are we? Yes, 51552 is our text, and thanks a million for all the texts that you are sending in. This was your first album I ever bought, was in 1973, The Man Who Stole the World. I was 13, and it was a life-changing moment. A lot of texts like that. Taking a nice big detour just to listen to the program. The car seems like the best place to be. 51552, I'm just thinking, we're not playing enough music. It's a lot of talk on the program this morning with Woody Woodmansey and Tony Visconti earlier on, and David Bowie now as well. There's more of David Bowie in this interview coming up now until 1 o'clock. So tomorrow, at least an hour of just music, okay? We'll play David. So what would you like to hear tomorrow? Of course, you'll all send in your text and I'll pretend that that's what you want, and it'll just be my favourite 10. Anyway, and by the way, I'll be doing my favourite 10 or a bunch of my 10 on RT Gold tonight at 6 o'clock for an hour with David Bowie stuff. But anyway, and we'll go back to the interview after we take a break, which is now 51552, your favourite Bowie songs.
Hey, you mentioned there that you were thinking maybe of giving up and maybe just going for the visual arts in some way. Now, the thing is, didn't you give up in one way in terms of you sort of told your fans, look, I am now doing a retirement tour, a hit tour.
But that was on the wave of a great new euphoria. I knew what I'd found back in myself, and I knew how I had to get back to what I was doing, and I had to make some kind of public manifesto that I would really be pushed by.
Yeah.
It was important, in a way, both with Tin Machine and the Sound and Vision Tour, to paint myself into a corner so that my choices were very limited. And the choice really was start producing great work or shut up.
Right.
And that was what I did virtually.
And now
I'm producing the great work.
Okay, wait a minute. The press release said something along the lines of, like, you have a fascination with living in the spectre of imminent apocalypse.
He was Ziggy. He was the thin white joke.
The point about it is, I mean, surely, since, like, 2 years before you were born, they dropped the bomb in Hiroshima. So surely imminent apocalypse is every day of the week since 1945.
The day I was born, apparently, according to the great tome that came out a couple of years ago, Jackson Pollock did his first dribble painting.
Great. There you go. So
that was apocalyptic in itself.
You were born the same day as Elvis. Does that mean anything to you?
Well, being an elitist, I much prefer the Jackson Pollock connection. Of course, when I was a kid, the idea that Elvis and I, and my cousin was in love with Elvis, Christina, and she had all those early 78s,
yeah.
And those girls at that particular time. So and she was like so happy that my birthday was the same as his. She said, "Oh, there's a family connection." So I was like 7 or 8 and having this put in my head. So it probably did awfully perverse things to me. I thought, I better be the British Elvis then.
Right, cool.
Well, obviously, I've got no choice.
Okay, well, then going back then to the Pinnacle of Planets that we were talking about earlier on, did you actually go to an Elvis gig at Madison Square Garden?
I did, indeed.
As Ziggy?
Okay. Yes.
Come on, you're stopping the phone, bro.
That's absolutely right. And I got there late.
It
was awful. Well, of course, I was totally unknown in the States. This was pre any kind of knowledge about me in the States.
This would be the Hunky Dory 70 direction.
Yeah, a little bit later than that. I was pretty much there with the short cropped hair on the platform, platform boots and all that. And I remember getting there late because my plane was on time, but the show was also on time. We thought it might be delayed or something, just because shows are usually rock shows. We didn't realize how professional and showbiz the whole thing was. And I got in there and started walking down the aisle, and I wished the earth would just open and swallow me. I thought, why did I get here late? And he didn't give me a ticket off or anything. I'm not sure. I know that he saw me coming in, and that he didn't make any comment.
But I mean, was he dressed in a sort of Las Vegas-y kind of hamburger?
No, it wasn't quite. It hadn't got to that full kind of ostentation. It was midway between the Las Vegas and the black leather.
Yeah.
So he still looked pretty funky. He looked pretty good. And he was thin and just looked. Remember, he was only like 30 years old. He was still pretty incredible.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, wow, that is Elvis, you know, up there, sort of 20 yards away, you know. It was an incredible thing to see. It was an incredible thing to see.
Do you think in some ways that getting married, that's actually made you a better person towards appreciating other people, if you like? That maybe you've even got more real friends now than you did maybe 20 years ago.
I'm not sure which, if it's chicken or egg.
Yeah.
I think probably I couldn't have carried out this relationship and continued it if I hadn't been in a place where I was ready for a real long-lasting relationship with somebody. So I had changed. I mean, I've been changing over the last 10 years. Always the chameleon.
Hey.
I guess I just got more. I probably had a greater grasp on the reality of what my life had become and what I wanted my life to become. So I knew that I really was looking for some kinds of emotional stabilities, you know, things that would kind of hold me to the, tether me to the ground a bit more. So I was in a good place when we met for that. And I guess the reciprocal love between us has kind of just kept me extremely buoyant about life. And I mean, love still. I mean, you know, it's as simple as that. I think being in love has an awful lot to do with it.
Right. What about being in L.A., say, in the mid-70s? Was it that bad? I mean, is the story true that you don't even remember recording station to station? Because if that's true, you should maybe forget some more. Sometimes
I can only think of one incident on Station to Station. It's the only thing I can remember. And that was trying to get L. Slick to... I remember working with Earl on the guitar sounds out in the studio itself, and screaming the feedback sound that I wanted at him. I remember doing that. I also remember telling him, take a Chuck Berry riff, dun, 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 and just play all the way through the solo. Don't deviate from it. Just play that one riff over and over and over again, even though the chords are changing underneath. Just keep it going. I said, what, man? And I said, it'll work, it'll work. that's about it. That's about all I remember of it. I can't even remember the studio. I know it was in L.A. because I've read it was in L.A. But I wouldn't be able to describe. I tell you what I do remember, though. What I do remember is that I believe the guy who owned the studio, it might have been that one, it might have been another studio, I mean, it starts to get...
Yeah.
He was also in a similar place to me. And he just bought this incredible house up in the hills with all the contents, and he invited me over one night and said, man, I got this like huge library, so all these books, you like all that book shit, you want some? So I went into the library and I found these 5 volumes of a 17th century printing of the works of Francis Bacon. I mean, it was just like, this is unbelievable. I said, I'll have these 5 if you don't want them. I said, yeah, it's just old shit. So I walked away with those 5 volumes of, with things like New Atlantis in them, and all his experiments, Bacon writing about his experiments about refrigerating chickens, which of course eventually killed him, because he froze to death while seeing if one of his chickens had frozen in the snow. Pre-refrigeration, incredible experiment, and the guy was just incredible. Only a few weeks later, the guy was found dead in his swimming pool with 2 birds also dead under incredibly mysterious circumstances. I remember that. I remember that. Things like that I kind of remember. There's certain bizarre high points that kind of like stick out like icebergs from the sea of mystery.
To turn away from drugs, then? Is it like spirituality that you have to find? Is that the route you take? Some people do, to get into the sort of back to a normal life.
Personally, physically, I was painfully emaciated, kind of later. Emaciated. I was just not even skin and bone. I was just bone. I was bone with these veins wrapped around them. I mean, I was the most, oh, God knows what weight I was, but I was way below, like, I think at some point I almost reached like 80 pounds, you know. It's just really, really painful. And also my disposition was, left a lot to be desired. I was just paranoid, manic depressive. It was all this usual paraphernalia, emotional paraphernalia that comes with abuse of amphetamines and coke and all that.
Okay, if you go back to your 20s and you're driven and you're now...
Who wants to go back to...
No, sorry, your 20s and age, and now it's the 90s and you're 50 years of age now and you're driven. What's the difference between the two drivens?
I think the early one was a drive. I have a drive now. I'm not sure that I'm driven. It's different. I have a motor which works at a 24-hour length.
Yeah.
I'm very aware of the day that I'm living through now. I'm very happy about being in the now in that way. And it sounds very neo-Buddhistic, but it's true. I feel very content with what I do on each day as it happens. But I think when I was in my 20s, I was always looking to the next thing. Yeah. I wasn't enjoying recording. I'd make records, but I was thinking about what the show would look like and where that and what we could do with that. And I was always three steps ahead of myself. So I never enjoyed process.
Yeah.
But now I really enjoy making an album and then actually doing the tour and enjoying the performances, you know.
Right.
And that's a different kind of feeling entirely. And possibly it's not possible until you get older. I don't know. I think when you are young, your projected event horizon is a lot more fascinating to you. You're always thinking about what you can do next.
Sure.
Or, you know, I want to do this, or just in regular life, if I get this job, maybe it will lead to this kind of promotion. And, you know, that kind of just a young man's ambition overrides more or less everything. And it really does change when you get older.
Right.
And I wouldn't have guessed when I was 25 that you could actually still have the same enthusiasm.
Sure. Yeah.
It's modulated in a different way. It becomes a different kind of... It has different characteristics. It's still there, the enthusiasm, but it's not so ambition-driven.
Cool. All right, David, thanks very much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Enjoyed it a lot.
Great. Good man.